Welcome. My name is Elliot Sober. I'm from the philosophy department. It's a great pleasure for me to welcome Mark Yaroshevsky back to Madison. Mark has been teaching at University of Calgary in the philosophy department since 1991. Before that, he was a postdoc at Washington University. Before that, he was a postdoc at Northwestern, working with David Hull. And by the way, postdocs are extremely unusual in philosophy and humanities general. So this is a very unusual trajectory in that respect. But before the two postdocs, he was a graduate student here. And I enjoyed working with him very much. Since he has been at Calgary, he published a widely used anthology on the species concept called The Units of Evolution. That was in 1992. And then in 2001, Cambridge University Press published his book called The Poverty of the Linnaean Hierarchy. And you can hear from the title how very neutral Mark is on the subject of the Linnaean hierarchy. It's great to have him here. And today he'll talk about Darwin and the nature of species.
Thank you, Elliot. Well, it's wonderful to be back. It's been a long time. As Elliot said, I was working on a PhD in the philosophy of biology with him. But while I was doing that, I also took a bunch of biology courses, genetics and botany, in zoology. I think pretty much everyone is retired or took courses. Is James Crowe here? Yeah, I took a genetic course with him. It was a great experience. I learned a lot. Anything I say that's biologically wrong, I did not learn here. I've acquired since then. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the species problem. What Darwin calls in the first page the origin, that mystery of mysteries. And I think he gets that phrase from Herschel, the philosopher and astrologer.
Astronomer, excuse me.
Now, you all know what the species problem is, of course, right? It's the problem of providing the correct theory of species, or to put it slightly differently, Darwin likes to talk about it in these terms, providing the correct definition of the theoretical term species. And what I'll focus on today is Darwin's solution, or Darwin's answer, or Darwin's approach to the species problem. And as we'll see, at least I'll try to articulate, it's an approach that is very much at odds with the majority view that we have these days on the nature of species. But nonetheless, I think it's a view that we can learn from. I think it's the right view, but more modestly, I'll say it's a view that we should take to heart and maybe can help us negotiate the debate about the nature of species an awful lot these days. So, what is his view? What was Darwin's view on the nature of species? Well, this is contested, of course. But perhaps the consensus view these days, and here's some representatives, people who have this view, is that Darwin did not offer a theory of species in the origin or elsewhere. And that's because Darwin didn't think that the species category, and I'll be clear what I mean by the species category soon, he didn't think it exists. It's a distinct category in nature. Now, lots of people are unhappy with this idea and attributing this idea to Darwin. So some philosophers, they say, well, this is very perplexing because Darwin gives us a theory of evolution. And as we know, species are the units of evolution. They're supposed to be the products of evolution. Maybe they're the things that evolve. So how can Darwin offer us an account of evolution when the main products of that category of those things is not supposed to exist? Right, so a lot of people don't like this. For my part, I don't find this a problem. As I'll sort of argue today, there's nothing inconsistent in arguing for evolution, but denying that there's a species category out there in nature. And indeed, what I want to sort of articulate is that a good chunk of Darwin's argument for evolution by natural selection turns on him denying that there's a distinct species category, which is bizarre, perhaps, to our contemporary ears. So this is what I'll do today. I'm going to spend a bulk of the time talking about Darwin's view and try, in a textual way, make the case what his answer is, what his approach is to the species problem. And then, to a lesser extent, I'm going to suggest that his answer has been confirmed by contemporary biology, and that we can learn a thing or two from it. Okay. So first, before Darwin, a distinction that many of you are familiar with, but it's worth highlighting, because I think his answer, his approach to the species problem, fundamentally turns on this distinction. So the species taxa, right, individual species, Homo sapien,
canine familiaris, whatever your favorite is. And then there's the species category. Right, species category is a more inclusive entity. It contains all species taxa. I think it's real. It's a distinct division in nature, distinct from the other Linnaean categories. And perhaps more philosophically, if you think it's a real category, you think it's explanatory in some sense. That if you say this group or this taxon is a species, that helps you understand the nature of that taxon, right? You know, so if you buy, let's say, the biological species concept, and you say, you know, this group forms a species, you can say, well, something about gene flow and maybe reproductive isolation explains why these populations within that group evolve in a cohesive sense. Now, the claim is going to be that Darwin believed in the existence of those taxa we called species, and it's not going to deny Homo sapiens is out there or Canis Humeris or anything like that. But he's going to deny the species category. Or to put it slightly differently, and we'll see this in a few minutes, he thinks that competent naturalists, that's his phrase, identify groupings or taxa, as we call them, and they identify, if they do things right, groups within groups, right, that sort of make up hierarchical tree of life. It's that grid, the Linnaean categories, or Linnaean ranks, that's put on that tree. That's what he thinks is artificial, including the rank of species. So let's get right into this notion of the species category and what Darwin had to say. I like starting with this quote. And sorry, there's going to be lots of quotes. But everyone's got a view about Darwin, so I'm going to make a case about Darwin. I have to really quote him a lot. So this is to his friend Joseph Hooker, the botanist, someone who he turned to a lot to get advice in his work. And Darwin writes to Hooker, "It is really laughable to see what different ideas are prominent in various naturalist minds when they speak of species. In some, resemblance is everything, and descent of little weight. In some, resemblance seems to go for nothing, and creation the reigning idea. In some, sterility and unfailing tests. With others, it is not worth a farthing. It all comes, I believe, from trying to define the indefinable." Okay, so I've added italics to the last sentence. Darwin's talking about the species problem, identifies four concepts in his day, then he goes to diagnose the problem. What's the problem? Well, he's not saying it's this concept or that concept. It's something more general. It's that the term species is indefinable. There's something more fundamentally wrong with the category. Now, why would he think that that theoretical term is indefinable? Well, in the origin, much of his argument turns on denying the distinction between what we call species and varieties. So just to key into a couple of quotes that do that, I'll use this quote. I'm going to skip some quotes along the way. So this is from Natural Selection. So Natural Selection is the book he worked on for 14 years before he published The Origin, right? He raced to publish The Origin. To publish The Origin because Wallace co-discovered natural selection. And so the Origin of Species is his abstract, and Natural Selection is a longer manuscript that was never published. And as you read The Origin, you know, he laments all the stuff he didn't say. Well, a lot of that was natural selection. "It is no wonder that there should be difficulty in defining the difference between a species and a variety, there being no essential, only an arbitrary difference." And it takes us up in The Origin as well. A very similar quote. I'm not going to read it. So this raises the question: why does Darwin think there is no significant difference between those taxa called species and those taxa called varieties? Well, he has a bunch of different reasons that you find throughout The Origin, and I'll go through two of these in detail. So one is that there's no process difference. If you look at those taxa called varieties, if you look at those taxa called species, there's not a process that divides them. Where differences are found, and he does talk about differences, and I'm not going to go through that here today, but where you find those quotes where he talks about differences, it's usually within a larger quote where he says, yes, but that doesn't fundamentally distinguish these things. Right? He sees them as pragmatically drawn. And the third, and I'll do that one, the distinction between species and variety is based on special creation, right? It's based on creationism. It's not based on his theory, which goes against that, and that's one reason he wants to get rid of this distinction. So let's go into this. But before I go into this, let me bring up one little point. So let's say you're sitting there and you say, wait a minute, Mark. But he wrote this book. It's called On the Origin of Species. Right? Didn't he write this book, Species? So what are you telling me that Darwin didn't think that species was a distinct category from varieties, right? There's the title of the book. And much hay is made of that. And I'll give you a quote from Meyer later as a representative sample of that. But there's an interesting thing. Does anybody know what title he... I'm curious how many people might know this. But that he proposed to John Murray, his publisher? Okay, that's interesting. I only learned this recently. He proposed this. He told John Murray his publisher should be On the Origin of Species and Varieties by Means of Natural Selection. And John Murray said, no, that's too long. And so he cut out the words and varieties. So I don't want to make much hay out of this because of, you know, psychological analysis, which I have no access to. But it seems that, you know, originally Darwin wasn't putting the sort of emphasis on species as a lot of people attribute to him. But maybe a cautionary note here at best. So let's go into a little more content. So let's talk about his tearing down of process distinctions between those things called species and those things called varieties. So in chapter 8 of The Origin, titled Hybridism, he discusses in great detail hybrid sterility as a mark between species and varieties, right? So he cites, you know, predecessors like Genre and Buffon. And the common view there is that you take organisms in different varieties in the same species, they can interbreed, have fertile offspring. But you take organisms from different species, maybe they won't interbreed properly, maybe if they do, their offspring won't be fertile, right? And you know how the story goes there. Well, much of the chapter is devoted to running through counterexamples to that criterion. Right, examples where organisms from different varieties, same species, don't have fertile offspring. Organisms in different species, what naturalists call different species, interbreed, and have fertile offspring. Right, so he goes through countless examples. And he gives us a sort of conclusion. It can thus be shown that neither sterility nor fertility affords a clear distinction between species and varieties. Right. I mean, a large part of that chapter is devoted to sort of knocking down that distinction. And then at the end of that chapter, so here he's knocking down that process distinction, but then at the end of the chapter, he thinks it has implications for the question about species more generally. And remember how at the end of most of the chapters of The Origin, we get the summary of chapter, very convenient for us readers. And he writes, well, finally then, the facts briefly given in this chapter do not seem to be opposed to, but even rather to support the view that there is no fundamental distinction between species and varieties. Right. So first claim, he didn't think that reproductive differences, whether it be fertility, sterility, reproductive isolation, other such things, don't mark a boundary between those things called species and those things called varieties. Okay, let's look at a different type of process that he talked about, and this is natural selection. And here we turn to chapter 4. I'm going out of order, that's okay. And in that chapter, he wants to talk about those processes that cause new taxa, the origin of taxa, to put it in a more neutral way, and also the biodiversity that we see, you know, sort of the gaps in morpho space that we see out there. And in that chapter, he introduces two principles, the principle of character divergence and the principle of extinction. So let me talk a little bit about these. And here I'm going to follow a couple of other people's work, recent work, Jim Mallett, a biologist, and David Cohn, a historian. And this is how they articulate these two principles. Now, it's actually three is where the work gets done that we need to do today, but just leading up to it. Right, Darwin observed this great variability among organisms that underappreciated and more arises through reproduction, though he doesn't know quite how. Of course, some are organisms, because of this, are better adapted to exploit old niches or maybe exploit new niches. Old story, right? Selection picks the fitter. Three is sort of the interesting bit here. So divergent selection is an idea from, or it's a phrase from Cohn. And it's the idea that divergent selection in itself, pushes organisms to further diverge from parent and sister groups. And so the idea is you have different groups of organisms. Within one, there's some fitter organisms. But then within that particular group, there's even more fitter versions of that phenotypic trait, and then even more and even more. until you get gaps between close relatives or groups. Let's get an example. So, not a precise example, but the sort that Darwin gives, and he talks about breeders. So let's say, I don't remember the exact bird, he's talking about breeding for feather plumage, and he says, well, you know, suppose the breeder wants to get sort of a colorful, ornate feather, and he has this group, and there's you know, the color is sort of pronounced there, so he starts selecting for those, but within that group, the color gets even more pronounced, the feather gets more fancy, and then he picks within that the fancier, and the fancier, and the fancier, until the resultant bird, right, is very different than the original stock. Right. And so this is supposed to explain the origin of new taxa, by the way. And then Darwin goes on to talk about this in nature. There's a famous example about grasses that he dives into in some detail. But the point being is it's supposed to be that selection and divergent selection, which Cohen calls an amplifier on selection, is that which causes the origin of new taxa, what we might call speciation, but he doesn't. Okay, so that's one half of it. So that's going to give you the origin of new taxa. And then there's this principle of extinction. As groups become better adapted, they outcompete the intermediaries, right? They're close relatives. And so that prunes the tree of life and you get the biodiversity we have. So it's supposed to be between these two principles, you're getting explanation of the origin of new taxa, and you're getting sort of the biodiversity, the gaps in nature, the morphic space that he observed, that we observed. Okay, so let's bring this back to the stuff about species and what Darwin thought there. Now, one thing that's interesting is look, there's no speciation mechanism here. There's no special speciation mechanism. There's nothing special about those taxa called species, right? He means this to apply in a generic sense, the origin of any divergent group. And interestingly, and Cohen points this out, Darwin doesn't use the word speciation, right? We're very familiar with that. That's a very familiar 20th century word. It's actually a good historical question about the rise of that word. When did that happen? Why? And stuff like that. But that was not Darwin's word. And so he tells us along these lines, the origin of the existence of groups subordinate to groups is the same with varieties as with species, namely closeness of descent with various degrees of modification. Okay. So why? What's Darwin's motivation for tearing down this distinction? Well, one is just that it's wrong, empirically disconfirmed. But another is that it's inconsistent with natural selection, right? It's previously drawn by creationism. So let me talk about that a bit. We can see why. I mean, here the target is why he might, in a larger scheme, be motivated for knocking down the species variety distinction. So again, predecessor John Ray, Lefant, Lyell, people like that, there's a special process, creation, right? So for every sexual species, there's a male and female created, and then they can reproduce, and they're reproductively isolated from others. But there's only that special mechanism for species, right? There's no special mechanism for making genera or varieties or anything like that. And so on the creationist mode, right, species are very different. Whereas for Darwin, right, I mean, he wants to explain what's going on via natural selection, of course, in a uniformitarian manner. So what do I mean here? Okay, so uniformitarianism, so that's from the geologist Lyell. The word is coined by Huell, another Cambridge person. Right, and in terms of geology, familiar with this, it's, you know, same processes over time. So just illustrated in terms of geology, right? So, you know, erosion is of various sorts now. Erosion of various sorts happened millions of years ago. Small changes add up to big differences. Right, the sort of wind, water erosion, bit by bit by bit, gets us the geological formations that we see in the Badlands, right, in the Dakotas. So Darwin wanted to take, pretty well documented, a sort of uniformitarian approach to explaining the origin of taxa and biodiversity as we know it, right? Same processes over time, natural selection now, natural selection then. Small changes add up to big differences. So going back to that notion of divergent selection, right? Slow incremental pushing to natural selection makes for new taxa and gaps, morphological or whatever type of gaps, between resultant taxa over time. Okay, so getting back, right? Creation requires a special mechanism. He denies it's a special mechanism, right? All taxa are due to the same general process. Thus, there's no distinction between the taxa we call varieties and species. Okay. So that's pretty much what I'll say about Darwin's argument against there being a distinct species category out there in nature. Now, then a question comes, okay, so what about all those taxa that we call species? Are those real? Well, he is a realist. I mean, he thinks that those taxa identified by competent naturalists are real. And more generally, there's this famous quote at the beginning of the chapter on classification where he gives sort of this realist approach to taxonomy. You know, look, from the first dawn of life, all organic beings are found to resemble each other in descending degrees. So they can be classed in groups under groups. This classification is evidently not arbitrary like the grouping of stars and constellations. Right. So this is harking back to something I said in the introduction. Right, so he believes those groups are real. They've done, taxonomy's done right. And he believes the classification of groups in groups can be natural, reflect nature as it is. But the claim I want to make is that there's sort of that grid we put on it. You know, these are species, those are varieties, those are genera. That is what he's skeptical about. And that turns to an interesting question. Okay, so what do you mean by this word? Right, if the claim is that he doesn't think that there's this real theoretical category, and he uses that word, what is he, you know, what's going on? What does he mean by this? What when he uses the word, what is he referring to? Well, he's pretty clear. Let's just do the second quote, maybe. Hence, in determining whether a form should be ranked as a species or a variety, the opinion of naturalists having sound judgment and wide experience, I like that, we should all need to have sound judgment and wide experience, seems the only guide to follow. And I've italicized only. And so the view that some people have, and I guess I agree with, and here I'm going to be following Wieslin and Beatty, is that, look, what did Darwin mean by species? Well, he just meant those things that competent naturalists were referring to. Right? So what do I mean by species? You know, those things those guys are talking about. So according to Beatty, it's just a mere referential meaning. What do you mean by species? It's just the thing that those guys are talking about. Well, what do you mean? Isn't there, like, don't you have a definition of what a species is? Well, no, there's no theoretic definition. I mean, Darwin's pretty clear that there's no theoretical definition. That's not disputable. Now, I mean, this seems weird in a sense, but Beatty sort of says, look, this is a pragmatic approach that Beatty takes. He wanted to argue and convince people about evolution by natural selection. And he needed to communicate. And A, he didn't want to reform language. That in itself would be a big enough task. But B, he wanted to say, look, those things you're talking about, I'm going to tell you why those are the result of natural selection. Though I'm going to stand back and not, you know, say they exist or have a theoretical definition. Okay, so that's Darwin. Now, as you might imagine, a lot of people are unhappy with Darwin's answer to the species problem, and in particular those that promote a biological species concept view of species. And their view, right, so this is them replying to Darwin, their view is just that Darwin was biologically naive when it came to species. He just didn't get it. And a couple of quotes on this one. So this is from Meyer. Darwin failed to solve the problem indicated by the title of his work. See, title of his work, right? We've got to remember the cautionary note about that. I've examined the reasons for this failure and found that among them was Darwin's lack of understanding the nature of species. And you get a similar one with Wieslin and other people, but I won't read that. So the view, if you sort of go into Meyer and Wieslin a bit, is that, look, you know, Darwin didn't have the biological species concept. If he had it, he'd have a good definition of species, and then he could, you know, think that there is a species category out there that's distinct from other types of taxa. It's just that Darwin didn't have it. So I want to just sort of briefly say that I'm unhappy with Wieslin and Meyer's response to Darwin's approach to species, Darwin's skepticism about the species category. And there's several reasons that I'm a little unhappy about this. First off, perhaps Darwin wasn't so naive, right? So he had this, you know, well-built theory about how ecological forces are more important than reproductive isolation for new taxa, and people like Jim Mallet claim that there's empirical evidence to support Darwin. Now, I don't actually want to go into the biological debate because I'm not competent to do it. I don't know enough about it. But I just want to sort of put this out there as, you know, look, there's some people think that Darwin was onto things empirically.
We shouldn't sort of dismiss his naive so quickly. Let me say a couple other reasons I don't like their criticism of Darwin, and these are more conceptual. So Meyer and Eason argue if Darwin had had the biological species concept, he wouldn't have been skeptical. But if you remember, there's that chapter Hybridism, chapter 8, which is devoted almost entirely to arguing against something like a reproductive species concept. It's not exactly Meyer or Gieselin's interpretations of it, but it's pretty close. So it's not like it's not like Darwin didn't know about something like the biological species concept. But I think a bigger thing is I think they sort of miss his target. Remember that letter that he wrote to Hooker? He talks about the different species concepts, and then he says, look, the problem is they're trying to define the indefinable, the whole category. I think what's going on in Darwin is it's not this or that particular concept that he wants to get in his sights, to use a metaphor. It's that, look, natural selection, as he sees it, bulldozes the distinction between varieties and species. That if you bind natural selection in the way that he envisions it, as a sort of uniformitarian notion, that's what kills the distinction. Right? So I think it's more of an inconsistency with a more general theory. It's not about picking or choosing the right species concept. And then there's a third reason. They put a lot of stock in the biological species concept solving the species problem. A lot of people are skeptical about that. Now, I mean, undoubtedly work around the biological species concept for decades and decades has been incredibly fruitful. But the claim can be made that it hasn't solved the problem. And so what I want to do now is turn to contemporary biology. So backing off from Darwin and sort of say, look, you know, I think we can get an argument from contemporary biology for Darwin, what I've articulated as Darwin's idea about species. So we're going to make a slight shift here. So Darwin gave us, in that quote from Hooker, four concepts. And as you well know, we haven't whittled those down, right? It's not like we have one or two right now. In fact, it's gone the other way, dramatically. So here's an example. This is from Hay. Here's 24 species concepts. And these are not crank or fringe. These are probably all well-funded by the federal government at some point, researching it. Of course, legitimizes them. I'm not going to talk about all of these. Instead, I want to highlight three particular approaches to species in contemporary biology. One is the interbreeding approach, which you guys are familiar with, right? That's best codified by the biological species concept. Another one is an ecological approach. A bunch of people have supported that, but I'll cite von Fehlen as a source. A species is a lineage which occupies an adaptive zone minimally different from that of other lineages in its range and evolves separately from all lineages outside its range. So it's been a lineage, maybe an ancestor descendant lineage of populations that's meant to be a cohesive entity or evolutionary unit or whatever you want to call it. By stabilizing selection. And then a third approach, a phylogenetic. But this gets a little crazy because there's many concepts that go under the designation the phylogenetic species concept. And David Baum has done wonderful work at disambiguating and doing the critique of some of these. Hay mentions three of them. A recent piece by de Quares mentions four types and then subdivisions. I just want to key into a particular brand of it that Mishler and a bunch of his co-workers and lots of different publications, where they just want to say, look, it's a clay, it's the smallest deemed worthy of recognition. So here's the argument I want to run, and I'll go into details of it. It's just foreshadowing it a bit. Right, so the claim is that these different approaches to species pick out different types of taxa or lineages out there in the world. They're all significant and important for understanding how evolution occurred. So no particular approach can claim to be the correct definition. Because the class of taxa we call species is heterogeneous, there's no species category in nature. Nevertheless, the taxa we call species are real. So my job for about 5 or so minutes is to articulate this. So the claim here is that this is the same conclusion as Darwin's, but it's a different argument. Our Darwin's argument obviously was on the variety-species distinction, where this is the claim that given the heterogeneous nature of the class of taxa we call species, we should doubt that there's a real category out there.
Now, that is heterogeneous. Is here I'm probably covering old ground, but not all that interesting. So, but let me just sort of briefly mention it.
Right. There's the recognition that these different approaches sort groups of organisms in different ways.
Right.
Interbreeding approach doesn't recognize asexual species. Right. There's no gene flow, no proper reproductive mechanisms. Where the ecological species concept in the phylogenetic, they're okay with asexual, so it's going to sort organisms different that way. Another one has to be about monophyly. If you're developing a phylogenetic approach that believes that monophyly is required of species, then you're not going to have paraphyly, right? So for the phylogeneticist, complete branches on the tree of life contain all and only descendants of a common ancestor. Whereas the interbreeding ecological, they allow, well, you can have, it's got to be branches, but they can be incomplete. It has to have only the descendants of a common ancestor, but not all of them. Right? So they carve up nature in different ways. And they emphasize different processes. Right, obviously, interbreeding is going to approach is going to emphasize gene flow and reproductive isolation, or reproductive isolating mechanisms. Ecological approach puts its stock in stabilizing selection. I mean, the claim isn't that you can't have more than one of these processes occurring in a particular group of organisms. The point here is what they highlight as primary. You know, what's sort of the linchpin behind causing species coherence. And the phylogenetic approach, see, it gets a little tricky that way because it allows sort of any process can do it. Right, it can be selection, it can be reproductive isolation, it can be canalization or homeostasis of various sorts. But the linchpin for them is propinquity of descent, right, that you're going to have genealogical continuity. The different processes giving rise to different structures, right, monophyly versus paraphyly. The first one, I don't know, it might be more philosophical than you need to really hear about. You know, interbreeding approach has got to be gene exchange among individuals, you know, parents among populations to keep species coherence over time. Whereas for the ecological approach or the phylogenetic approach, it could be other mechanisms such that populations don't have to come in contact with one another. You can have selective forces working on isolated populations, or you can have canalization working on individuals, keeping some sort of species integrity without requiring some sort of causal interaction among the organisms in a generation. So, backing up out of all this, the claim is this. Look, interbreeding ecological phylogenetic lineages vary in significant ways. Pick out different types of groups of organisms, highlight different processes, have slightly different structures. Each type of lineage has played a role in evolution. I mean, you can't sort of say, well, look, you know, we're not going to study the asexuals, we'll throw those out, or we're not going to study paraphyly. Right? The claim is, look, all of them have played a role in understanding life on this planet. And so no particular approach is more entitled than another for the word species. And so in some strong sense, that class of taxa we call species is truly heterogeneous. There's not like in that group, and they're different in significant ways. Okay, so that's sort of leading up to that claim. But then there's this question, okay, well, that's fine. So you're showing this mess that we already know about. Why should the heterogeneous nature of the class of taxa we call species give us reason to doubt that there's that category out there? That it's, why should it cause us to think it's artificial? Okay, well, this gets a little more philosophical. And there's the question, okay, so what criteria should we adopt for thinking that a putative category in science accurately represents what's going out there in the world, is natural as opposed to artificial? Right. What if someone suggests there's this category in nature, what should be the threshold it should meet that we should say, okay, we think you're onto something out there? Well, here's a suggestion for such a threshold. If a category exists as a scientific category, right, that it's not artificial, we actually think it's out there in nature, it should meet these requirements, and these are necessary. First off, most entities in that category should share some common feature or features. So it's saying most, it's not saying all of them, right? So it's not any form of essentialism here. It's just saying, look, if you think it's a real group out there, then you should be able to make better than chance predictions about that group. And if you can't, then it's a predictively empty grouping for you. You can't make predictions about it. It should help us understand something about the entities in that category.
And the biological species concept, if it's the right one, is lovely, right? Because it sort of says, look, you want to understand the nature of all species and why they evolve such? Well, I'll tell you about why they interbreed and they have reproductive isolating mechanisms, stuff like that. It's very explanatory to understand the nature of members of that category. And then three, you'd like it to sort of distinguish entities in that category from entities in other categories. Right? So tell us what's different about species versus genera or varieties. So the claim, from what we saw before, is that the class of taxa that we've heard of species fails to meet this. Right? That they pick out different groups of organisms in the world, they highlight different processes, they have different structures, such that the claim that most entities in the category share a common feature is pretty speculative, and moreover, it's far from clear that there are certain significant features that help us understand the nature of all the entities thrown in that group. And you got to really sort of key into the heterogeneous nature here, right? We're not just talking about eukaryotes. I mean, we think about prokaryotes too. I mean, I haven't said anything about that. Now, you might respond, well, no. There is something that they all share in common that's explanatory. Well, they're all genealogical entities, right? They're all lineages, sequences of parent offspring or ancestor descendant population. So that's, you know, maybe one and two can sort of be met that way. But the problem is, see, that doesn't distinguish those things we call species from those things we call genera. Right? So you want something that's explanatory but sort of distinctive, to sort of think you have a distinctive category out there. And so the claim is we don't have that. And it's not because... And the claim here is it's not because we lack knowledge. It's more like we have lots of knowledge than this thing we thought was a real category isn't. David, when would you like me to finish?
Me?
I'll keep going. I just want to.
I don't know. What's the thing?
10 more minutes? Or?
I'll be fine.
Okay. So the claim here is that those taxa that we call species are real. I mean, that's an essential part of this argument. The category is not. Same conclusion as Darwin, but different argument. And this first argument, I think, from microbiology, that would amplify this, if not even show that the species category has even further problems on its hold on thinking that we have a real category out there in nature. Now, in the last 15 years or so, a bunch of philosophers and biologists have, you know, they recognize the heterogeneous nature of those taxa we call species, but they sort of try to look for the unifying theme, as it were, so they can say there is this unified, distinct category. And I'm not going to go through hardly any of them. I'm just going to mention one which has lots of popularity these days, and that's Kevin Duclair's general lineage concept. And according to him, he says, you know, there's all these concepts, they all disagree on lots of important things, but they all agree, that is all the warring concepts out there, whether it be phylogenetic or interbreeding or ecological or whatever, they all agree that species are separately evolving metapopulation lineages. Actually, the meta is not so important in there. Population lineages. So what happens, so what's the relationship between the general lineage concept and the other concepts? Well, discrepancies among the other species concepts are just over evidence for inferring the boundaries and numbers of species. Species are really lineages. All those other disagreements, that's just about evidence. It's just sort of, well, other quotes from Kevin, operational quibbles, methodological quibbles, epistemological quibbles, but species are really lineages. Okay, I'm doing this sort of quick. I mean, to do justice to his work, I really should spend much more time on it. But I don't think this answers the species problem for a couple of reasons. One is, I think, he's wrong when he says that proponents of other concepts are confusing methodological issues with conceptual ones. When someone is promoting a monophyletic view of species says paraphyletic can't be species, they're not making the claim that, oh, I'm not getting the evidence right. They claim paraphyletic aren't species. They can't be. Right? Interbreeding folks are denying that asexuals can form lineages. I mean, the claim here is, look, these different proponents think that they're talking about different types of lineages, different types of phenomena. Right? And that's what species are. They don't think they're quibbling about evidence over the same kind of phenomena. Right. So I think it requires sort of sweeping those discrepancies under the rug here. Right. So there's a necessary requirement all species have. But these other guys think these other components are pretty important.
because merely being a lineage is not going to be sufficient for, and a lineage here can be something that's non-monophyletic, paraphyletic, or monophyletic. Lineage is not going to be sufficient for an interbreeding approach. It's not going to be sufficient for a phylogenetic approach.
The other problem is I think it's too inclusive.
Right, he doesn't highlight distinctive category because, you know, higher taxa in the Darwinian framework are lineages as well, parent of populations.
Okay, a couple of things before we end. So how should we understand this term species? If I make the case that we should be skeptical about there being that category out there. Well, there are the species skeptics who say that we should just eliminate the word.
And there's some people, and they suggest how we should replace that word. They give us, you know, alternatives. In some cases, and in other cases, people just say, you know, forget the whole, all the main ranks, including species.
I guess what I'll suggest today is look, junking that word is both impractical and unnecessary. Impractical because how entrenched it is in biology and society more generally, whether it be field books, textbooks, or even laws. Darwin didn't want to go that route and try to reform language in that sense. But perhaps more significantly, it's unnecessary. We don't have to get rid of the word. We just have to be careful in how we use it. And indeed, we are. I mean, this is more reporting. It's not articulating a new position. Here's a suggestion about how we can, you know, even though we might be skeptical about the word, how we can get on with the business of biology and retain it. Well, if the meaning of the word affects our understanding of a study, then be explicit about the approach of species being used. So there's lovely cases in biodiversity studies where people will count the number of species within a certain taxon, I don't know, whether family or order, I'm not sure what. And they use one approach, like an interbreeding approach, but then they do a comparison between the count for this higher taxon, and they'll compare it to a count in another higher taxon, but that count is done by an interbreeding approach. I don't have quotes here, but I mean, there's lovely sort of cases where people are not comparing like to like because they're using different approaches, but yet they're comparing the numbers. So in cases like that, you want to be clear about what you're counting, what type of thing you're counting. But there's other cases it doesn't really matter, you know. So you know, if I want to say here's a taxon, this is part of that one. I'm going to call this a genus. I'm going to call this a species. There you don't have to be clear. Is it interbreeding, phylogenetic, or whatever, right? You're just indicating level of inclusiveness. Or if you're sort of casually referring to two groups as a prey species or a predator species, things like that. So the suggestion here is parallel to Darwin, right? Darwin was skeptical of the species category, but he continued using the term. And he continued using it for pragmatic reasons. And so that's the claim here. I mean, you can be skeptical of the species category, but you can still keep it for practical reasons as long as one is careful in how it's used. So a couple of concluding remarks. So Meyer and others argue that Darwin was naive when it came to species. However, I've tried to show that Darwin's arguments against the species category are a bit more sophisticated than they articulate, that they give him credit for. And then the last part of the talk, I try to say there's evidence for Darwin's skepticism about the species category from contemporary biology, and one type of argument along those lines. The other thing that I just want to say is I like Darwin's navigation of the species problem because I think it's a nice, useful path between what I'll call species optimists or defenders and species skeptics. You know, on the one hand, you don't have to sort of worry about getting the single unified definition of species. But on the other hand, you don't have to sort of follow the skeptic's path and say, oh, then we have to get rid of the term. Stop talking about that term, right? This is sort of a nice, what I consider a practical or pragmatic sort of path between these two positions. Though arguably it's closer to one than the other. So I'll say anything about that. So let me end with a talk on Darwin. We always like to end with a Darwin quote. So this is the conclusion of The Origin. When the views entertained in this volume are generally admitted, we can dimly foresee that there will be considerable revolution in natural history. Systematists will be able to pursue their labors as present, but they will not be incessantly haunted by the shadowy doubt whether this or that form be, in essence, a species. So I guess the exhortation I make is, let us follow Darwin's lead and stop being incessantly haunted by the need to define the word species.
That's it. Thank you.
evolutionarily unique character within a group solve some of these terms, definitions?
I would suppose that that would just, then you'd have trouble figuring out what is an evolutionarily significant character, and then the whole dispute would raise itself in another guise. I mean, in a sense, these guys are disagreeing about it. I mean, in a sense, the species problem is trying to figure out what is an evolutionarily significant character.
So I am a microbiologist, and I know there are several others in here. I wonder if you could say a few more words about some of the challenges of microbiology and prokaryotic systems.
Right. Right. Well, you'll know this better than I will. So, I mean, there's different approaches within microbiology on how we should think about species and ranking, right? So there's people who say, well, maybe there's some sort of recombination approach we can use, and there's skeptics of that, right? And there's people in Cohen who promote, I think David was saying he was here last year, right? He promotes an ecological approach, and then there are skeptics of that. And then there are people who use various genetic markers or parameters for getting species, right? I mean, it could be rehybridization, it can be, I mean, I'm not going to remember, there's other lots of different markers that people use. And so, I mean, there's two ways that it goes there. I mean, one is you get these people who just sort of say, the only sort of approach that works in a uniform manner is just sort of a pragmatic approach, that all these approaches I just mentioned are problematic and disagree. And so we should just be skeptical that there's a species rank out there. Right, so I mean, more detailed, right? This is a claim about that, you know, so we're talking about lateral gene transfer, right? This is a claim that a phylogenetic approach, right, you're not going to get whole genome species at all. I mean, you might get something like evolutionary units that are gene cluster based, but they're not whole genome. And so you can talk about those, but it's weird talking about them as species. Right, so the claim is that look, some of the concepts have been applied from eukaryotes to prokaryotes, but a lot of people say those are problematic. You get a lot of people who are sort of think what's more pragmatic, because you can sort of slice up the world in various ways because of lateral gene transfer, whether phylogenetically or through recombination, and that we should buy a sort of pragmatic approach. I guess what's sort of interesting about that, though, is if you go into the philosophical literature, when people try to unify the notion of species as these sort of coherent things that have the same causal mechanism, it sort of goes out the window when it comes to prokaryotes, but that's a whole other.
I guess, you know, I find myself wondering, you can make a distinction between believing in the existence of a species like human versus species as a concept, and to me it's not entirely clear that either work in prokaryotic system.
Right. That's right. People would make the case, right, so species taxon, there's a higher skepticism there than you know, nice big mammals and birds and all that. I mean, we all know the story of that, right? I mean, some of us, right, we sort of learned our notion of species and theory of species from people like Darwin and Meyer, who like birds. It doesn't quite reflect the things that you're working on.
The one thing that really comes to mind that I noticed that you did was when you talked about the reality of species taxa. You know, you said, well, what did Darwin mean? He meant things that a good naturalist calls, you know, a species is whatever a naturalist first do, a good naturalist. If you're going to make the case that you have that the species taxa have reality, it would seem that that is a fairly flimsy basis for arguing, you know, for sort of building an argument for reality. To say that anything that in the modern world, you know, there's all these different concepts. So long as, according to one of these concepts, this group constitutes, is recognized by people as a species, then it is real. I find that sort of unsatisfying. I would prefer to take the position that while within any of those approaches, there are real groups, but there isn't a real rank of species. And I wonder if you'd like to comment on that alternative structure.
I think that's exactly... I shouldn't say exactly. We used the word too quickly. But I think that's what Darwin's up to. Right. It's... Right, there's groupings and groups that we should have confidence in if it's done by the appropriate competent naturalist. Right, but the rankings we should consider artificial. So I think that's what's going on with Darwin. So when you say, it sounds confusing when you say he believed in species taxa. It sounds confusing because it's not really he believed in species taxa. He believed in those taxa that some people call species, right? That there were groups. But the word species confuses us in thinking that they thought it was more than just properly recognized groups, whatever the heck rank they might have.
So you're saying he believes in the coherence of that as a grouping at some level? Is that the
thing? Yeah, that's what I would
say. Yeah, that's exactly right. No, he thinks that, he thinks it's Homo sapien. But to say that there's this real category called species, that's what he's denying. Right, so he's not a skeptic about classification done by competent naturalists done in the right way. It's just that he doesn't, when you put ranks on top of it, that's what he thinks is artificial. Right? Just think of that sort of quote about, he doesn't think that classifications, grouping in groups, is arbitrary, like stars and constellations. Right? So he's a realist about the tree of life and how we construct it. That's a real fact out there. It's just that when you have that tree and you say, well, these things are species and those things are genera, that's what he's skeptical about.
I'm wondering if there isn't a bigger gap between Darwin's position and the position now of people we might call pluralists. And partly I'm thinking this because, at least in some passage, Darwin seems so much like a phoneticist. I'll come back to that in a minute. But the difference I'm hearing is the difference between vagueness and ambiguity. Let me just... Now I'll turn to the rest of you. And I'll say it's Mark. So in philosophy, we distinguish these. So vagueness means a concept where there's this underlying matter of degree thing, like being bald or rich or smart. There's no precise boundary between when you've got it and when you don't. It's a matter of degree. Ambiguity is a very different category. So the word bank in English is ambiguous between financial institutions and river sides. Each of those can be very clear, and the term has different meanings. Okay. So pluralism, to me, sounds a lot like the idea that the species category is ambiguous, that these different things you might mean depending upon what kind of organism you're talking about, and there's no single meaning that the term has across all uses. So that's an ambiguity thesis. But Darwin, when he talks about species versus varieties, it seems like a vagueness thesis. That is, you have two populations diverging from a common ancestor, and when they're just a little different, we say they're two varieties of the same species. And when they get more different, we then decide we're going to call them different species. It's a matter of degree, and there's no fact of the matter about where the cutoff is between variety and species. And to me, that just sounds like phoneticism. But that's not where pluralism is coming from in modern discussions, which isn't really phonetic very much at all. The phylogenetic species, kind of the ecological, the biological species. None of these are phonetic concepts at all. And there, it seems like ambiguity is more like what's going on than vagueness.
So, why does it sound phoneticism?
Because it's similarity that leads us to say, oh, these are two varieties of the same species. And if the organisms are not so similar, we say, oh, they're different species. I mean, I'm thinking this is what Darwin is saying in certain passages.
He does.
And it's just overall similarity. That's why I say it's phonetic.
What about all those passages about hybrids?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not clear to me that...
Yeah, there are other places where Mark had a nice one where some people think in terms of interbreeding, other people think about similarity, still other people think about this, and then it sounds like this ambiguity. Those kinds of passages sound like the modern pluralistic ambiguity kind of idea.
It's a common goal between ambiguity and vagueness.
Well, okay, so maybe there are two Darwins.
He was ambiguous on that point.
Maybe there are two Darwins, but some of the arguments seem just like straight ahead phoneticist arguments.
Well, let's see. I mean, if he's making the case for vagueness, right? I mean, he definitely makes the case sometimes that phonetic distinctiveness or similarity is not going to draw the boundary. I mean, he does make the case against that, against phoneticism in places as well. But there's a sort of more general question. Every time he does do the vagueness argument, is it, in a sense, a phonetic? I mean, it's interesting because a lot of the quotes that I have, right? It does talk about characters in that sense. But I mean, I do get the sense that he doesn't. I mean, he's not a purely phonetic spinozist when it comes to the nature of taxa at all.
Excuse me. I'll
Yeah, that's good. Please.
What's phonetic mean?
Oh, just I take it what Elliot's talking about is just you know, how do you do taxonomy? You get clusters of groups that are similar. The more similar, the least inclusive they are. Right. So you just do an overall similarity. It's how you do your classification. I take it that's all you meant, right, Elliot?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think that's good. I'll play with that. But I think the answer is actually within the text, right? His approach is more diverse, and it's pretty fundamentally a quasi phylogenetic view. Is that?
That's what I would say. But
yeah.
What troubles me about the definition of early so-called definition of species, I think what troubles Darby too, is that it's conceived in a day and age where species is still a divine and finite creation, whereas we now know anything about that. So I think when Darby argues, his argument for vagueness probably is somewhat phonetic in that sense, because there really isn't. We now know. I mean, there's just really no definite species. I don't even think that he really defined species in the presentation. I mean, even though there was
for him,
there's lots of attempts to, but you can't really do it. So it's the gist of what I'm saying is I think it probably is somewhat phonetic argument. But in other words, I agree that there are group. I think that calling it a group of similar things or taxa is probably the best way to go about it.
See, but I don't think it's entirely a phonetic argument in the sense that, remember, I talked about him arguing against process distinctions. Right, I mean, you know, he feels so vagueness is one argument, but I mean, there's other arguments against the species variety distinction. So the one about how divergent selection is the cause of new taxa, whether you want to call them varieties or species. Right, so it's not. I mean, species are not just phonetic things for him, or those things that people talk about as species, not merely just phonetic things. Please, yeah.
You sort of, I guess, alluded to this a little bit at the end of the talk, but well, it's important to look at it, the argument you've been having now for about the past 5 minutes, the flip side, going back to sort of the hierarchy could be debatable, and what's a variety, which is whether it has to be a line, and then there isn't necessarily one. At the same time, everybody needs to be able to be on the same page when you're talking about something. So, sure, calling something a species may be somewhat arbitrary at times, or calling that particular level of taxonomy a genus or an order. That's fine, but everybody's got to be speaking the same language. I mean, the chemists all got together and had IUPAC and said, this is how we're going to name molecules, done, so that everybody can speak the same language. So how do you match that need with this idea, okay, but I may be saying something different when I say species than you?
Well, the claim isn't right. I mean, you have species skeptics who just say, you know, forget the term. We'll just talk in terms of, let's say, clades or whatever you want. Or then you have, I mean, David sort of proposes a view where species are groups out there, but the ranking itself is not real in nature. I mean, I don't know pragmatically how you do it. I don't have a case for that. I mean, I'm just sort of making the case that we have good reason to think that there isn't that real ranking out there, but and this is sort of, you know, it's I mean, the suggestion at the end here is sort of a way of, well, you know, we can sort of keep the word around, we got to be clear about what we mean by it. It's just sort of representing how we do it, but we don't sort of endlessly sort of figure out what is the right definition of it.
In you're conceptualizing what a species is, do you kind of think that there's really two classes of definitions? There's those definitions based on how you conceptualize them. So you can talk about ecological species or interbreeding species or monophyletic species, and it's in the realm of theory, and yet the competent naturalists are the monographers. And try and apply any of these concepts to making a monograph where you're attempting to put everything within that box called a species. And there's a real disconnect between those two classes. There's, again, the conceptualization versus the practical monographic needs. All of those theories become very difficult, if not impossible, to use in practical monographs. Did you kind of think of it in that way when you conceptualized what?
Well, for better or for worse, right, I mean, being a philosopher, I stick on the conceptual end of things. So I sort of show the mess on the conceptual end. I mean, I'm very sympathetic on the practical end, and I would think that would reinforce sort of worrying about what the heck this alleged category is. But I didn't, I mean, I don't have particular views on that. I mean, I would think that would speak, I mean, what do you think? I mean, I think that would speak also about problems with this notion of ranking as well. That we sort of have these idealized models of how we do the ranking, but they're very idealized compared to how we actually practically do it. I mean, it's really great. I mean, Linnaeus was really lovely because, and actually a lot of, you know, taxonomists are this, who wrote systematic texts, you know, they sort of have this ideal system about how it's done, and then sort of realize, well, you know, can't do it that way, and they do it a different way.
But, well, what I was getting at is not that so much as it's really, there's two different ways in which people conceptualize species. Again, you look at Van Valen's concept, and mm-hmm. and he talks about red oaks versus swamp white oaks. Well, that's a no-brainer. You know, they occur on dry hillsides versus in swamps, but how many species can you apply an ecological concept to? I mean, what's a niche? It becomes an impossible practicality. Mm-hmm. And so, and interbreeding concepts, we don't have the data to apply those. And monographers don't have the practical gene trees in order to apply the, say, a monophyletic kind of concept. So there's a disconnect between the concept and the application. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Right. That's undoubtedly dead on. I took when I was a grad student, I took a species course with Iltis, and Iltis kept telling me that this is ridiculous, I have to go out in the field. Stop talking about this stuff.
Yeah. So I have kind of a comment and a question. So in my experience, debate about species concepts, and you showed us this, has been going on for a long time. And so kind of the comment is, it's been going on for a long time. You're suggesting the reason for that is there's no real way to define species, and thus we're not arguing about it because we're not really arguing about anything real. But then there's the other side, which is that people sometimes express very strong opinions about the right species. And I wonder, I'm interested in your insight and any other insight into why it is that people have such strong opinions about this.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to do psychological analysis or sort of analysis of history ideas and why that's so strong to us.
Right, the philosophical perspectives, I guess, I'm wondering about.
I mean, this is more about, you know, the history of science and why we're wedded to certain ideas. I mean, I have, you know, speculative views upon this stuff, but it's not, you know, stuff about how, you know, we're inheritance of sort of a Hellenistic view where we like things, you know, broken into nice groupings, and so shouldn't everything have a nice grouping and it be ranked hierarchically, and that's a holdover from, you know, a couple of thousand years ago. We're sort of still in that grip. So I mean, one claim, I guess, you can put it this way, is I'll just say this about it. Is, you know, people sort of argue that, you know, particular taxa don't have essences, that essentialism there has been dropped out, right? You know, there's no essence to Homo sapiens or Canis Canaris, but we haven't dropped out the notion that there are these ranks that have essences in some sense, and they're real out there, and that we sort of need to drop that as well. But that's speculative. You're talking about groupings and taxa, right? So the question is about the species category. Right, so the intuitive idea that nature, that there are these gaps between these different types of organisms, and there's really neat differences in morphospace and stuff like that. Right. I mean, the intuition that there are real things out there and what we observe, that there's a correspondence. But that's a different question about whether the ranks that we apply are real, and why do we still have that?
Okay, we're out of time. Why don't we thank Mark?